صلِّ على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم صلِّ على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم صلِّ على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are speaking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it valid to join a congregational prayer when the congregants are in the final tashahud of the prayer?
Right. Well, if the worshipper arrives at a congregational prayer when the imam is reciting the final tashahud, in order to receive the reward of participating in the jama'at prayer, one is allowed to say the takbiratul ihram and then immediately proceed to sit and recite the tashahud along with the imam of the jama'at or congregation, stopping short of uttering the final salam or taslim, because he has just joined the prayer. Mm-hmm. He cannot do the taslim along with the imam, of course. And when the imam is finished with the salam, the worshipper should proceed to stand up and, without repeating the intention and commencing takbir of the prayer, he should recite Suratul Hamd and the second surah as constituting the qara'ah of the first rak'ah of the prayer. So it will be counted as the first rak'ah, because he has to recite hamd and surah and then proceed to the ruku' and sujood, and again he has to stand up and do the and recite hamd and surah. So after he will gain the reward of the jama'at prayer, but then when the jama'at prayer ends, he will continue his prayer as farada. Mm. Individual prayer.
I see. Sheikh Tawbi, does testimony concerning the wilaya of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, peace be upon him, in the tashahud invalidate the prayers?
Well, this issue has begun to emerge in the subcontinent, Indian subcontinent. There are some people who want to sow seeds of differences and disunity among Shia Muslims by raising up this issue and creating doubts on the minds of the people, telling so-called scholars, telling that it is permissible to add to the prayer what is not part of the prayer. Like, for example, the wilaya of Imam Ali should be added to the prayer because it is an essential, very fundamental belief in the Shia Islam. Of course, there are many fundamental beliefs. We have no right whatsoever to add to the prayer what is not part of the prayer. And that's what we call bid'ah, okay?
Right.
Every right, every fundamental issue that we believe in cannot be added to the prayer, because the prayer has its own shape and form, structure, which came to us and from the time of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. Now, in this time and age, we have no right to add to the prayer something which is not part of the prayer. So, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the prayer, including the tashahud, should be recited in the same way as the miraji of the religious authorities. The Maraja Taqlid have mentioned in their books of Tawzih al-Masail, Practical Laws of Islam, and one should not add anything to it, even if it's true, even if it's correct.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear audience, for joining your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. And the topic we have had in this episode was some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanur Rahim,
Bright Sunday greeting to all of you. You are with Iran Radio, and we are delighted to present you the lineup for the next hour. Stay close. We've got a meaningful day ahead. Our next program is Africa Today. Then we have For Humanity. Next up, it's time for Round the World with Reporters. Get ready, because Africa Today is coming.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes doors, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening it. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs for imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the Global South. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Ireti Bakare Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, and a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chiguka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Bureau will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration, basically because Africa is the richest continent on Earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as food, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all the problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chiguka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs, to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AFCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA, really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly we should get to it. And I can't say, I mean, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. And must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
I definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states, and also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.?
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was a reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively. While some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes, Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face, before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa, and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education, because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya, who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guest today, Irete Bakare Yusuf, and Zizwe Chibuka for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Janatali, will share more on this.
I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. One of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Asfiya Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Asfiya Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to our program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings and Quranic elements pertaining to humanity and mankind. And in the previous episode, we started covering a very good book in this regard, titled A 250-Year-Old Person or A 250-Year-Old Man, which is a combination of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei about the life stories and biographies of the great leaders of Islam, the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the successors of the Prophet from among his pure progeny. So, we were talking about the challenges that the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, had throughout his years as the leader of the community, and also his personal characteristics. And we talked about the triumphant return of the Prophet to the Mecca and how he showed love and forgiveness, not just by words but by actions, especially when he was the most powerful person. He forgave all those people who had killed his close relatives, like his uncle Hamza and other people. And he taught Muslims for eternity that forgiveness comes before everything else. Now, another incident that took place in the final year of the Prophet of Islam was the incident of Ghadir al-Khum. Now, the incident of Ghadir has one Shi'i aspect that in Shi'i Islam is studied, but because it's an incident in the life of the Prophet of Islam, Muslims cannot just ignore it in general. And it has a role to play for the overall ideology of Islam. Now, before the Ghadir, we should contextualize, we should put in context Ghadir. Before the Ghadir, the Prophet of Islam, he performed Hajjatul Wida, the last Hajj performed by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And in that Hajj, in that pilgrimage to Mecca, the Prophet of Islam taught Muslims everything they needed about the rituals of the pilgrimage. And in Mina, in one of the ritualistic stays throughout the process of Hajj, he delivered two sermons. Okay, there is the Sermon of Mina, but the most accurate account is that he delivered two sermons in Mina, one on around the day 10th of the Hajjah, and the other after Ayyam al-Tashriq, which would be around the 13th of the Hajjah. Okay, so, and when we analyze these two sermons, we realize that it has a great political and social connotation in it. And these sermons have been transmitted in both Shia and Sunni sources of hadith. So he starts talking about jihad, about the struggles in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he would say that the struggle against pagans continues until that everyone accepts monotheism. And this is not just a matter of like temporary matter. The struggle continues as long as there is oppression. The struggle continues as long as there are ideologies that would enslave people. Pagan ideologies are like that. Pagan ideologies are the basis for the enslavement and oppression against people. And if you remember, in one episode we said that all the oppressions and all the injustice throughout history, they originate from wrong ideologies. And when we talk about Tawheed, we want to ultimately establish justice, because everything else other than true tawheed would enable and would justify oppression and injustice. Okay, we're going to have a break and we come back to continue the discussion.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa.
Welcome back. We were talking about the sermons of Mina delivered by the Prophet, and this is For Humanity from IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to your program. Now, the topics that the Prophet covers in the Sermon of Mina, we said that one of them was the struggle. The next is the unity among Muslims, that Muslims should not engage in civil war, that the sanctity of the blood of a Muslim is emphasized there. This is a people that they immediately, it was possible that they would immediately go back to their default tribal system, okay, because I'm from this tribe, you're from that tribe, you have a fort. No. According to Islam, all Muslims are equal, and you do not have the right to start a rage war based on those things. So, about the values of the era of ignorance, era of Jahiliyyah. Now, this is a challenge that the revolutions have, that after a while, people start going backward, irtija or irtidad. They start going back to the values of the era of the pre-revolution era. Okay? And for the people of Arabian Peninsula, it was very possible that this short time, although the Prophet spent a lot of energy and time educating people, teaching them about the values of Islam and everything, still it was possible that they forget. If you have been trained and raised in an environment for 40 years, and those habits and customs and values that have persisted over centuries, right? So it's very difficult to change them in a matter of 20 years, 15 years, 10 years. So that's why the Prophet would always leave a mark that you should not go back. You should not. And the values of the era of Jahiliyyah are all under my feet. The values based on, I don't know, tribal affiliation, about the financial positions of people and everything. Ala wa kullu ma'tharatin fil jahiliyyah tahta qadamayha tayn. Anything remaining from the era of Jahiliyyah are under my feet. They have no value. Now we have set a new system of value in Islam, which is based on piety, which is based on obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And those privileges, those things that you thought if you're born in this tribe, you have privileges. And in our time, you would say sometimes these things exist. Like, for example, if you're from that nation, by default, people respect you more. If you're from that, I don't know, community, you have more chances of having a job. If you're, no, all of these are wrong. All of these are new forms of Jahiliyyah and the era of ignorance, tribal affiliations or tribal mentality in a different form, in the name of nationalism or in the name of other things. People should only be valued based on their performance, based on things that is under their control, not the things that are out of their control. Okay, so this is just some of the topics covered in the sermon of Mina. Inshallah, in the next episode, we're going to cover other topics that the Prophet ﷺ talks about in the sermon of Mina. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolimi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
At least 110 Palestinian abductees have been killed while in Israeli detention. That's according to a new report. It said many of the detainees are regularly subjected to torture, assault, medical neglect, and malnutrition.
After October 7th, Israel's systematic violence and torture against Palestinian prisoners increased rapidly, and this is not only reflected by the increase of fatalities, but also in the witnesses we hear from and the ex-prisoners. Gaza's prisoners are still subjected to more brutal and inhumane treatment, which was noticed more clearly since Ben-Gvir came into office. His policies are reflecting his own extremism.
Ben-Gvir, who oversees Israel's prison system, openly boasts about rising fatalities in Israeli jails. Those close to Ben-Gvir maintain that the hawkish Israeli minister is proud to have aggravated conditions for Palestinian abductees.
I was in prison for nearly 2 years, during which I was subjected to extreme torture and medical neglect. For 4 months, I had scabies, and they refused to give any medicine. Starvation was another method of torture. We would go for days without food, or with the minimum that kept us alive. We witnessed the death of many people inside the prison. One prisoner was Dr. Mossab Hania, who was tortured to death for his last name only.
In addition to the 18,500 documented arrests since October 2023, there are an unknown number taken as part of an Israeli policy of enforced disappearances. 2 years on, thousands of those disappeared from Gaza may no longer be alive. For the 110 Palestinian prisoners who never made it home, the suffering may have ended. However, for the thousands who are still behind the Israeli bars, the agony persists. Nada Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah City, Palestine.
Again, 120 people were murdered in a massacre by the RSF militia as they attacked a kindergarten, a village, and a hospital. Most of the dead were children aged 3, 4, and 5. The massacre against civilians had been conducted in the village of Kalogi in South Kordofan. Diplomats heard during the presentation of the new report on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
And sometimes the situation and the facts are distorted, so we want to shed light on the developments in the country, and also we know that now the UN is saying that Sudan is the largest humanitarian crisis, and so we would like to see why the situation is going in that direction, and what is the magnitude of this humanitarian crisis, and also what is the support that we can get from our partners in the international community.
The new report sheds further light on the UAE's technological and military assistance of the RSF militia. The report says that the shortest way to achieve peace and end the suffering of the Sudanese people is to hold the UAE accountable for its aggression. However, a recent EU Parliament resolution removed the mention of the UAE at the last minute.
UAE are supporter of the
Abbas and Magels, but after some diplomatic interventions by the UAE, the European Parliament opted to adjust its call on the world foreign countries that influence the conflict.
We will keep providing humanitarian aid to ease the suffering of the Sudanese people. Sustainable and safe delivery of humanitarian aid in Sudan remains to be an urgent need to ensure uninterrupted delivery of humanitarian aid.
On Tuesday, an aid convoy of the World Food Programme was attacked in Hamra El Sheikh in North Darfur. It was the sixth such attack this year that has so far led to the killing of eight World Food Programme workers since the beginning of the year.
It's the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. 30 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid, 15 million of them children. There are 10 million internally displaced people in the country. We're active in Sudan in principle and want to increase our efforts. But there are regions like Al-Fashir that are inaccessible to safe access.
Two unprecedented humanitarian crises, famine and genocide, have been unfolding in Sudan and Gaza. Although witnessed by millions online, the international community remains unable and unwilling to stop them. Economic and political ties with the perpetrators and states supporting them, most notably the US and the UAE, seem to be more important than human lives in West Asia and Africa. Dieter Reinisch from United Nations in Vienna.
Iran is preparing to host a fresh and potentially decisive round of mediation between Pakistan and Afghanistan's Taliban regime next week, in what is being viewed as the most ambitious diplomatic effort yet to break the deadlock between the two hostile neighbors. The Tehran talks stand out due to the anticipated participation of China and Russia, signaling that leading regional powers now view the escalating Pakistan rift as a direct challenge to wider regional stability. The Tehran initiative follows deadly border clashes between the two uneasy neighbors and earlier rounds of negotiations in Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, none of which produced a breakthrough.
This is a significant development, and what makes the Tehran talks particularly noteworthy is the expected participation of China and Russia. Their involvement signals that major regional players view this standoff between Pakistan and Afghanistan not just as a bilateral issue, but as a potential threat to wider regional stability. Tehran is leveraging both its political weight and the presence of two regional powers to create pressure for dialogue and compromise.
This mediation effort follows recent visits by Iran's senior security and diplomatic officials, reflecting Tehran's urgency to calm rising tensions between Islamabad and Kabul.
Since we have seen the Israeli occupation in Palestine and we have seen the atrocities of Israel, we have seen the very positive, very impactful role of Iran in the region. Iran has started maintaining its foreign relation with other and neighboring countries. So I believe that Iran this time could be a important mediator as compared to the other one, being in as I have already mentioned, that immediate neighbor, being a state, a stakeholder, so having projects with India, being a state. Because we have been blaming Afghanistan that their land is being used by India in creating proxies in Pakistan. So I believe this time we have a mediator that could play a better role than the previous ones.
In the run-up to next week's meeting, Iranian diplomats have intensified shuttle contact with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
With tensions at their highest in years between Islamabad and Kabul, the Tehran mediation round will test whether coordinated pressure from Iran, supported by China and Russia, can open a path toward restoring trust and containing cross-border threats destabilizing the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material, wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets, once lying discarded on the roadside, have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, He set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transform these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
Pakistan's capital Islamabad marked the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention of this Crime. A seminar was held bringing together former diplomats, members of parliament, think tank researchers, university faculty members, and students. Speakers reflected on historic and ongoing genocides targeting Muslim communities, saying Gaza today represents the world's gravest moral failure.
9th December, and by the United Nations, it's declared as the Genocide Prevention Day, and especially to pay respect to the victims of different genocides. I must appreciate all the people in South Africa and all the other different countries, have showed their courage to support this issue and to support the people of Palestine, and especially the students of different Western universities. They supported this issue more.
Participants described the situation in Gaza as catastrophic, urging Muslim countries to stand united to defend the rights of the Palestinian people. They said nations like Iran, which have shown firm diplomatic resolve and a strong stance against Israeli oppression, can send a powerful message to the world.
I think it requires the realization and united action by the entire Muslim community around the world. It is not only some people who raise their voices and it is then forgotten. Well, Iran has taken a stand which is a beacon of light for all of us.
Meanwhile, a Muslim unity conference was also held on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Participants from diverse backgrounds rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, calling it a complete fraud.
The so-called peace promise made under Trump's leadership is nothing but a fraud. There is no ceasefire. The massacres continue. The genocide continues. Even the areas Israel was supposed to withdraw from remain under siege, and aid is still not reaching the people.
The participants emphasized that Gaza has become a defining test for the Islamic world, urging Muslim nations to take a united stand against occupation, injustice, and genocide of Israel.
Public anger keeps growing across Pakistan as the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated amid international silence. Many fear that without global action, the catastrophic humanitarian crisis will intensify. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was observed at the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa compound in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa. A ceremony was held on Tuesday, bringing together representatives from the UN, the African Union, and ambassadors from various countries. The event highlighted decades of suffering faced by the Palestinian people, both in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Palestinian people's suffering has intensified under decades of a belligerent